Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today, I'm joined by Yannick Jacob, who is an existential life and leadership coach. And we're going to be exploring a few things today. Yannick is a podcaster, has a podcast on coaching. And I thought it'd be fascinating just to check in with him. What is he sensing in the field as he speaks to all these different people? So we'll talk about some of the key themes Yannick has taken from his podcast. We're going to talk also about his approach to coaching, positive existentialist coaching, why Yannick loves this approach, which combines positive psychology and existentialist theory. We'll talk about what it brings to coaching. And I just really appreciate Yannick's sincerity, his love of coaching. I think that shines through. As I said, Yannick is an existential life and leadership coach. He's a positive psychologist, a coach, trainer, and supervisor. He's the program director of the accredited certificate in integrative coaching at the School of Positive Transformation. He is part of the teaching faculty at the School of Life, the Animus Center for Coaching, and has written a book, An Introduction to Existential Coaching. If you appreciate this podcast in general, or this podcast in specific with Yannick, I'd just really appreciate it if you would consider leaving a review. It helps us to elevate the podcast and get more exposure. And if you're interested in finding out more about Coaches Rising, you can head to coachesrising.com. Let's dive in. Here is Yannick Jacob. So Yannick, it's really good to be with you. And I'm excited about our conversation today. We met just before Christmas, and I really appreciated both your energy and your playfulness, your sincerity, and your love of the coaching field. So it's really good to have you with us. How are you doing today?
Joel, thank you so much. I'm doing well. I'm always excited about these kind of conversations, especially when I'm talking to someone that feels just very aligned. And it's like, I'm sure you've listened to many other podcasts. It feels like you already know someone and you already have a relationship, but then you realize, oh, they haven't actually met you yet. And so it was really nice that when we first connected, live, synchronous, that it was such a good vibe, so I'm excited about where we're going to go today and what's going to emerge from this, and hope people will find us helpful.
Yeah. So we will go in a few directions. Of course, you're a coach, you're a trainer of coaches. You've created the coaching lab. You're really immersed in the field of coaching. And so I want to talk to you about your philosophy of coaching. We'll get into that, but I actually want to start by talking about how you see the field of coaching right now, because of how plugged in you are. You're hosting your own coaching podcast. So you speak to coaches and you create podcasts about coaching for yourself. So maybe you could just begin at that high level of, like, what do you see as being some of the key themes and challenges out there for coaches right now?
Yeah. Well, we could, with that alone, we could talk for hours and go into so many different directions. The first two themes that pop up in my mind as I hear the question is, on the one end, AI, and how the scalability of coaching, of the methodology of coaching, of the transactional bits, how that's going to change the industry, how that's going to change people's attitude towards coaching, its popularity, how people receive it, but also particularly in my field, training, supervising a lot of coaches, how is that going to impact human coaches' coaching style and philosophy, right? So I think humanistic, existential, anything that Gestalt, for example, narrative coaching, a lot of these approaches that are really grounded in creating a human-to-human relationship, really being present to what's happening in front of you, paying attention to, these dynamics that are difficult to intuit for someone who's not human. I think that'll become a lot more prevalent in coach training and in CPDs and in what human coaches need to be tuned into, because learning coaching as a set of skills, transactional skills, or a process, guiding somebody through a process for growth or transformation, chances are that'll be done probably a lot better by AI than most human coaches will be able to. So what makes coaching human and really tuning into that? So AI is a big one. I'm not sure if we want to stay there or open the other one up too.
Yeah, let's just stay with AI for a moment, because this has obviously been a theme on the podcast, and I really agree with you, and it's uncertain how it's all going to play out, you know? So,
Oh, yeah.
but it certainly feels like for sure it's going to double down on what makes us really human, you know? And maybe even that might be a positive side of AI with all the potential downsides that AI might bring, you know? It might really reveal to us even more clearly what it means to be human. And so, yeah, could you say a little bit more about, like, for you, what are some of those kind of, I don't know, call it coaching skills, ways of being a coach, maybe even a better phrase that you think, yeah, are the ones we might
Yeah.
want to practice?
So integration has been a big theme throughout my life. So I really don't think it's going to be an either or. Like either it's going to be a human coach or an AI coach. So I think what's going to be important is how do we integrate partnering with an AI? How do we integrate AI into coaching practice? So I've like about a couple of months ago, I sat down and kind of summed up all my thoughts from recent conversations. And there's a whole list of possibilities of how we could be partnering with an AI. And you know, that's really exciting. That's the part that I don't find so scary. What I find a little bit scary is, well, if people rely on an AI coach rather than a human coach on its own, because it's going to be so much more affordable. You know, there's also an exciting part in that because anywhere in the world with an internet connection could tap into someone who can guide you through a process and help you think. And that's going to be valuable. But I see it a bit as the kind of more traditional performance coaching, right? Following a certain process, such as the GROW model, for example. You can, after, you know, a weekend's training, help somebody go through a conversation and think a little bit better and consider some things. You know, it's very limited, but it's useful. So I'm excited about the usefulness of what we have learned through coaching, but the process of coaching being available to so many more people. But then there's possibilities like, for example, we just chatted before we started record, a colleague of mine using AI summaries on Zoom. And how many coaches have I had in supervision who say, oh, my client asked me to sum up the session, you know, and send them a couple of notes afterwards. Well, you can have that done, you know, and it's surprisingly good already. I didn't think it was. Nothing convinced me up until about 2 months ago that this was going to be very useful because it makes up a lot of information. But just one ChatGPT version beyond, and it's going to be really impressive of what it's going to be picking up. So I think as long as we take the information that AI offers in and see how it can benefit the coaching relationship between two humans, I think that's really helpful, right? And supervision, it might pick up on certain moments where the AI analysis noticed facial expressions or, you know, a little bit into the future, even physiological signs, you know, easy to connect your AI with something that notices brain frequencies or reactions in your blood pressure, for example. So as long as AI doesn't interpret that for us, but it gives us more information, I think this could be a really exciting space. Imagine you have a second screen where there's just like information running that could really aid the coaching process. It'll, by definition, take us away from being present with the client right now. But then if we think about presence, wouldn't that include other information as well? Presence doesn't mean just being in the present moment necessarily. Presence might also mean keeping the goal in mind or, you know, looking at what's happening in your own body. What are my own emotions? How might I be triggered here in this relationship? At that moment, your presence is being taken away technically from being 100% with your client in front of you. So I think a second screen with more information could be seen as the screen that we have inside of us or, for example, looking through a systemic lens at what the client is telling us, listening from a narrative perspective, you know, putting our psychodynamic glasses on for a moment and see if there's something that we can learn here about the client. So I think there's possibility. And I had my dark moments with AI and you know, there's still a good possibility it'll wipe us all out. But, you know, if I put my optimistic glasses on, I'm thinking about opportunity and possibility, and there's certainly loads of that.
Yeah, as you speak, I'm almost getting a sense of like a third person in the coaching relationship, the AI presence in the space with us that could offer input to the coaching conversation in some way, you know, in a positive way that helps deepen the coaching in some way. So,
well, that's an interesting philosophical question, just to jump in, right? Because is this a presence, a third entity in the room with us, or is it just another set of information that could be compared to any other theoretical information that might operate in the background? It just happens to not be in our brain and operates there. It just happens to be outside of our brain as, you know, an extension to our brain that gives us more information.
And I guess the question there might be, what is more advantageous, or what's more beneficial to us? Because I know that it doesn't take much for these AI present, you know, these AI kind of chatbots or avatars to seem human. You know, it doesn't take much interaction. So, is that a negative thing or is that a positive thing? So, I could see it going both ways. You know.
Yeah, and I think this will be something that we'll definitely be facing. I'm pretty certain about that, because I'm in two minds about that. Imagine you're talking to an AI. I would have no issues lying to an AI, you know, not really, because I know it's a computer. It's like, am I going to turn up on a self-study course? Well, there isn't somebody there. There isn't a human relationship that offers accountability. And, you know, it's something special to be in the presence of someone human. I think it makes up a lot of the value that coaching offers, is that we are in this relationship. And we cannot just get out, because there's no guilt when we cheat a computer, you know? So, but if we don't turn, if we don't show up to our coaching session with a human, I think most people will, you know, feel something. But for an AI, just reschedule. No feelings are getting hurt. So exactly. If now the AI pretends to be human or doesn't disclose that it's not human, we arguably get more from the coaching. But it's arguably unethical, because every AI should disclose that they are an AI. It's a bit like the placebo effect, right? If you were to tell somebody it's a sugar pill, they get zero effect from it. But if you tell them that it's a very powerful medication, you'll get very powerful results.
Yeah.
Woohoo.
I had the same thought myself. We'll move on to like another theme you might see in a second, but I had that thought myself of like, you know, easy not to turn up to the AI coaching session or switch it off halfway through. You know, we've got to a challenging place in the conversation, just switch it off, walk away. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that social contract between two humans just isn't there. But maybe so we could talk about AI and for a long time, but what other themes are you seeing from your investigations?
The second big theme that came up is how far can coaches go? And I've been thinking and talking about that for a long time. It started with my own coach training, because very early on, I wanted to move beyond the traditional kind of coaching approaches that were out there. That's why I started with existential coaching. You know, I was a positive psychologist at the time and studying an MSc in positive psychology. And I felt I needed more when I work with people in the coaching room than positive psychology. I felt I needed to integrate a lot more. I wanted to go deeper and I wanted to have more profound conversation. Not that positive psychology coaches don't have profound conversations, but I was always interested in therapy and counseling. I was interested in that kind of depth in that kind of relationship. So from the very get-go, I was interested in integrative approaches and how could we combine elements of coaching and therapy in the interest of the client, you know, that we don't need to refer so much as somebody else. And then the client needs to build a new relationship with someone else. And it's all, you know, I would have loved to bring those together. So over the years, I've seen coaches go further and further. I've seen the profession expand from this performance coaching, you know, going into all sorts of areas. Now, coaches work with bereavement and grief, and they work with trauma, and they work with addiction. You know, we have so many people overstepping traditional lines. But then when I talk to them, some are clearly, I think, clearly unethical because they don't have the training to hold what's there. But others, they bring so much to the space. And just because they don't have a formal therapy qualification or certification or somebody giving them the stamp of approval within an institution, the mere act of holding space for another human being, giving them everything that you've got, your full presence, being curious, not just trying to guide them based on what you know, but really holding space for someone to do their own work. That seems to be one of the commonalities that I found when I talked to all of these thought leaders in coaching. A lot of them from a lot of different theoretical approaches, it keeps coming back to just being there in a space, being really present, you know, holding that space, helping somebody to figure things out, reflecting back what the question seems to be, or reflecting back body language or communication, making observations, you know, but not pushing this into any particular direction, holding what you think you know lightly and helping somebody to figure things out. Now, that's what so many approaches have in common. And if you just look at that, if you were to step into the room, somebody does that for 10, 20 minutes, I'm not sure if you could see the difference between coaching and therapy. No. Clearly, there are differences, but then it really depends on what you mean by coaching and what you mean by therapy. So that's been an ongoing conversation. And as coaching matures and develops and expands, you know, and given that it's unregulated, this conversation around where's the line, are the lines helpful, are the lines crucially important and keeping clients safe, and then we need that. That's a very interesting conversation, and helping coaches figure out where their lines are, at which point are they out of integrity, at which point might the client be at risk, you know, might I be overly confident, might I not be confident enough, you know, how far can I go, how far am I willing and able to go with this person, how much space can I hold? And if I knock on the door with a client, the proverbial door, can I hold what's behind it? Do I want to? There's emotions coming up. Now, am I willing and able to hold the emotional depth that just opened up? At which point might it be in the client's best interest to work with someone else? That's, yeah. You know, these questions are out there, and they're out there for almost every coach.
Brilliant questions. And I relate to them a lot. And you know, something you say there touches me around my own journey of becoming a coach, and the passion to be with a human being in the way you described, you know, to be present with that person and meet them in their fullness, their wholeness, and you know, be able to support them in their unfolding of organically where they needed to go next. And and that quite quickly for me, it felt like the paradigm of coaching, as some people held it, was too small for me to meet the person in that way. And that, yes, I wanted to learn about trauma and about therapy and about how to help people meet some of these difficult challenges and emotional repression and content that can show up in a coaching conversation. Mm-hmm. And so I see that, and I wonder how this feels for you. I see that in a number of people that I talk to and I learn from, there's a kind of cross-paradigmatic approach to coaching, which I really admire about them. You know, like they're being informed by different systems, you know, and that allows them to then almost take a trans-systemic approach. You know, they can pick up whichever system is needed in the moment, but actually what they facilitated in their journey is that level of attunement that you're talking about, and presence, where they can really meet that person. And it's, in a way, it's like the beginning art of coaching, but it's also the, you know, the upper echelons of the mastery of coaching. So yeah, I don't know if there's a question in there, but I trust you'll just riff on it.
Yeah, what I take from it is that this notion of maturity, right? I'm not sure how I feel about mastery, because it always feels to me like we've arrived somewhere when actually, you know, this can be in the way of really tuning in and approaching things with a kind of child mentality, beginner's mind. But there's arguably, I think there's a level of maturity that we reach that helps us be in tune with, am I in a space where I'm the right person to work with it, right? There's a humbleness, an awareness about what's going on for me, and am I out of my depth here? Am I working within my competence, capacity, capability? And checking in with that without losing presence, being able to know how to have a conversation in the client's best interest, so it doesn't feel like rejection when you might want to refer them, but it feels like you are so supportive that you're willing to not work with them so that they can find the right person to work with. So I think people can come into coach training having already reached that kind of maturity as a human being, that ability to check in with yourself and that ability to face some difficulties, having worked through some stuff from your past, so you know why you're getting triggered and when you're getting triggered, what are the signs and how can you refocus and recenter, figuring out which ego states you're working from, or, how you can recenter yourself, what's happening in your body. So there's a lot of people coming into coach training feeling like, oh, I'm not really a coach yet, when actually they bring so much to the table already that they could go confidently into a conversation. Whereas others, they might have been coaches for years, but they're just not really reflecting to a point or being attuned to a point where their own ego gets in the way all the time. And I think one of the biggest skills to learn, and I do think it's a skill, is that we recognize how our ego wants to interfere and then try to navigate that so that it doesn't interfere with a process and the best possible work doing it for the client. So I'd love for coaches out there to recognize where they are in terms of maturity and what they bring to the table. So because I think then we can make decisions on a case-by-case basis, whether I can still go further, whether I'm still the right person to work with.
Yeah, beautiful invitation there. And actually, I'd like to include now your work and positive psychology and existentialism and how you put them together. Mm-hmm. And then we can kind of carry on this conversation about coaching inside of that context. So could you say a bit about why you decided to put those disciplines together? We can also say what they are as well. So
yeah, thank you. So I had mentioned, right, I kind of fell into positive psychology back in the day, just because the second master's in the world happened to be at my university. And this Ilona lady turned out to be a pretty big deal. This Ilona lady who ran my undergraduate positive psychology module. I never heard of positive psychology. Ilona Bonneville is, one of the pioneers in positive psychology. So I found myself in her office asking, hey, can you tell me more about this master's by Seligman, the only master's in the world? And she says, yes, there's another one here with me, and we're starting cohort 2 in September. I had written my undergrad dissertation about flow. So that I'm like, I'm going to do that then, because that's very much how I've been like for a very long time. Something arose in front of me and I just said yes to it. So here I found myself in studying the science of what's right with people and what are the resources and strengths that we can build on, which we had surprisingly little empirical data on. People have thought about what makes a good life and what makes happy people for, millennia. But we hadn't really had good science on it. So I was very excited about the whole positive psychology movement because I've always been a bit of a rebel and like things that don't exist yet and really kind of go out and break some barriers and look at places where people haven't really looked before. So I found myself in positive psychology and getting so much excellent stuff that's just directly related with coaching. And then I found out that coaching exists because they're just so aligned, right? Coaching is often described as the applied arm of positive psychology within positive psychology coaching, right? Because that's the practice where we can draw on what we have learned from science, maybe put it on the table for clients or let it guide our inquiry. So I've been then immersed in that world. But then, as I mentioned before, right, I needed to go a level deeper. I needed this to be grounded because a lot of my positive psychology colleagues, how I often say, they were a little bit too positive for my taste. I needed an approach to working with people that recognizes and acknowledges that life is often really hard. It's really tough. It's super challenging. Just being alive in the world with other people, just being human. Our human condition is one characterized by conflict and dilemma and paradox and anxiety. You know, we can't help it. That's always there. And most psychologies acknowledge that there's tension and conflict within us, and that out of that, you know, energy is born. So when I heard about existential coaching, an early mentor of mine recommended it. I look into it because I was looking, he knew I was looking into integration. Nash Popovich is amazing. He also founded the first master's in integrative coaching and counseling at the University of East London. So worth looking into that kind of literature. And when I found existentialism as a philosophy, grounded as a philosophy that you could ground your practice in, I immediately recognized it as something that seems integrative. Right? Because the nature of the existential questions, you know, who am I? What's the meaning of life? What does it mean to be human in a world with other people? You know, how much time do I have left? Existential themes such as authenticity and endings and uncertainty, isolation, absurdity, the quest for meaning, but not really being able to find the meaning of life. You know, we can believe in it, but, you know, we cannot know anything really with that amount of certainty. The big questions, and within those questions, all these paradoxes that really I found once you make your way through the dense existential philosophical literature, it's so tangible, and everybody who's human gets it if you manage to tap into their human experience. Everybody has had deeply existential experiences, and they usually have them all the time. So what I found throughout now years of practicing is that when somebody brings something into the coaching room and they want to work on it, it's always connected to existential themes, to bigger questions that run underneath the surface. And so when we develop an existential lens, it's not that we have philosophical conversations all the time. It's not that we say, oh, you have some Heideggerian death anxiety going on here. It's more like you start getting curious about what bigger questions influence that thing that you're bringing to the coach, that can be very tangible, very practical, how to get the next promotion, you know, might be connected to my relationship with belonging or my relationship with authenticity, my idea, how do I see myself? What's my sense of identity or identities, you know? So I found just a very fertile ground in existentialism to integrate all of these tools, techniques, questions, inquiries, all of this wonderful stuff from all of the world of philosophy and psychology. But it formed the basis of how I make sense of myself in the world, in my relationship with others, and my relationship with the world. And that works for me. So within that, I can pull in things from other disciplines, such as positive psychology, which was kind of my main lens at the time. And combining them made intuitive sense to me, even though it seems a bit paradoxical to combine the very often very portrayed as dark existential. We are sitting in French cafes, smoking Gauloises and philosophizing about how nothing makes sense and we're all going to die. And, you know, there's nothingness at the center of it all. With my positive psychology lens, I immediately recognized it as very liberating. It's very empowering because it's really about giving people choice to choose who they are, to make sense of themselves in their world. And there's so much more choice and autonomy that people can take, you know, when they choose to do that. But as soon as they choose to do it, the responsibility of their choices often weighs heavily on them. So at first I got very passionate about everybody should take on this lens, obviously. And now I realized, you know, a couple of years in that, hey, people choose to live their life in the way that they want to live their life. And all what I want from people is that that's a conscious choice, that they understand what they're choosing. And if somebody chooses the simple story and somebody chooses not to fluctuate so much in how much they're experiencing, and that's okay. If somebody doesn't want to feel pain, you know, want to avoid as much pain and suffering as possible, then I get it. You know, they're also most likely missing out on the other side of the spectrum. You know, if you don't allow yourself to fall in love because you want to avoid getting hurt, you're missing out on all the joy that love brings. You know, if you're being transparent and show people at work or in your community who you really are, you make yourself vulnerable because then people know who you really are. And if they criticize who you really are, that goes deep and it hurts. But if you don't show them, you protect yourself. It doesn't hurt so much, but also people don't really know you. So all of this kind of philosophy really served me as offering more choice to people. And I believe that one of the main purpose of coaching is to open up choice for people so they can have more autonomy. And that just worked so well for me. I found my home in that philosophy because it allowed me, it gave me something really grounded, really solid, at the same time flexible to integrate more that I come across in the world.
There's a lot in what you just said that brings up a lot of questions. Just let me ask one question now, which is, as you talk about this this choice, you know, it creates choicefulness, and you said, yeah, you know, if somebody chooses not to love because it's vulnerable, then, you know, that's okay, but they may be missing out on, you know, they're missing out on this beautiful thing called love. So it sounds like to me that as you work with people, people are able to become more agentic and choiceful, and that process involves a kind of enlivening of them. Or I'm curious about that, because in a way they're having to embrace that uncertainty or the pain, but on the other hand, they're getting a reward. You know, they're getting uncomfortable and they're finding more enlivenment and happiness inside of that. And so is that what's going on? And how do you see that working, really? You know, like, this sounds like quite a somatic process, or it could be, you know, it's a very embodied process.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I've only found myself into more embodied practice much later in my practice. My modus operandi is still quite cognitive. But like, if we don't make the connection to the body, then I think we're missing out on another world, right? So I know there's a lot of coaches out there whose dominant lens is somatic or cognitive, and I think we do need both. Anyway, so just got taken on a tangent. I think what we need, we were talking about that choice, right? When people recognize that there's a choice, they're missing out on so much. But if that's how somebody wants to live their life, if they, it's connected to values, right? So that's why exploring values and beliefs, most coaches would do that. In existential coaching, it's crucial, right? If you have a value, strong value around security and protection, then chances are you're going to choose to protect yourself and open up less and have more walls up. Some people have a much stronger value in being adventurous, you know, taking more risks, and they will make different choices. So I stop believing that there's a better way to live, even though I believe that a better way to live is to get all the experiences that life has on offer, right? Mm. I would want to, you know, on my deathbed, know that I've lived, and for me, living means to experience the spectrum of what's on offer here. But if my values were different, I would make different choices, and then I would have no regrets. And what I want for people is that they have no regrets at the end of their life, whenever that is. No, and it could be tomorrow, could be in 5 minutes, who knows, right? Yeah. So on the basis of our values and beliefs, we make choices. So exploring what those values are, and are they really ours, or have they been kind of implanted in us? They always have to some extent, you know? But exploring that a little bit, not necessarily going way back into the past and reviewing your whole child's history, but like acknowledging that your past shows up in the present, and we can listen to the story that's happening in the present, even if that means some of what we talk about might be, how did those values develop? Because on the basis of those values, we make choices. And if we manage to figure out which of these values are authentically me, which can I own, which might I choose, even if we recognize they were someone else's value at some point, you know, then we can own our decisions more. And the more we own our decisions, the more authentically we live.
And how do you help people do that, to tune into what's my value, what's an inherited value?
Yeah, a part of that is what you mentioned, right? It's part of it you can tell by how somebody's showing up, just by how they hold their body. Some people intuit that. They can sense when somebody's not really congruent in how they tell a story. And sometimes you just check into their story. How do you know that? You know, whose voice is that? You can go an IFS route and talk to the parts and see, you know, what they have to teach you. You could ask someone around, tell me about your story. Like, where did you come from? How did you grow up? Tell me a bit about how you've arrived here today as the person you are. And you can either sense or you can pick up on signs whether that seems to be a congruent story. You know, this can be a logical process. This can be an intuition process. And I remember being coached, working with my very first coach. I was still in training. And I had just talked for a while about, I don't even know what it was anymore. But at some point, there was a moment of silence, and he kind of leaned back and he looked at me and he's like, I don't know what it is, but somehow I just don't believe you. Like, this, all of this, I don't know, you're just like too casual about it. It doesn't seem, I don't know, I can't quite put my finger on it. And it really took me on the back foot. I'm like, huh. And then I realized that it was allowed me to reflect on that and realize that, oh yeah, this, some of that had been a story that I was telling myself. And probably to some extent, I did try to convince myself of that story, because it allowed me to keep doing what I'm doing instead of making a change that feels risky and bold. You know, so I think it's these moments in coaching where you are in tune with yourself and you offer an observation. Existential coaching, many other forms of coaching too, but existential coaching particularly, it's paying attention to what's happening in front of you. And it's in this human to human relationship where you meet someone at eye level and you offer what's going on for you in the interest of the client, in the interest of their awareness. And that's a magical space, you know, and it's a different kind of coaching than when you guide somebody through a process. There's a number of clients that we don't set goals. You know, we agree that we're going to start exploring. Something doesn't quite feel right. And there isn't a big vision at the end of it. There isn't a smart goal at the end of it. There's just, let's agree to have a conversation and see where it's going. You know, a bit like our podcast today. So sometimes there's themes and we decide that, okay, let's open up those themes and see what's there. Existential coaching isn't necessarily a solution focused. It helps to, if you have a vision that you want to bring in, let's explore, right? But if there isn't that clear vision or that clear agenda, let's have a conversation. It's not solution driven or focused necessarily, but we create space and we pay attention to what's happening in front of us. And we listen through that lens of, what's your relationship with the existential givens? What's your relationship with these themes that are inherent in the human condition? And when someone explores and gets clear on their relationship with endings and where it came from, then a lot of other things will start making sense. You know, because endings also means beginnings, endings, temporality, right? Death is perhaps the most significant ending in a human. But that also means change. Any change process requires something to end and something new to begin, even if it's a very subtle change. The version of you that hasn't made the change needs to die in order for the next version of you to go forward and is now different. And so every time someone gets married, for example, I would like to acknowledge that there is a significant ending. And that can make people feel quite weird, because it's supposed to be this joyful event where you look forward and you're not allowed to have any negative thoughts around it. And it's not a negative thought to acknowledge that this is a significant ending and a significant limitation to the person I can be in the future if I stay true to my commitment. No, having kids freaks a lot of people out. And rightly so, right? This is probably one of the biggest commitments. My daughter is turned 2 this week. So you can't really go back from that. You know? Yeah. So I think recognizing these relationships and listening as a coach and explore the relationship that somebody has with meaning, with endings, with isolation, their sense of connectedness and belonging with other people, you know, uncertainty, authenticity, identity. When we learn to listen to those themes, they can massively elevate the conversations that we have, because they often take them somewhere where we help a client create some answers to some big unanswerable questions. And once they choose that that is their answer, a lot of other things fall into place.
Yeah, what I really, let me name one quick thing, and then I'll, like, you said this person you're with shared, you know, hey, Yannick, I just don't believe what you're saying, you know, in that conversation you had. And that I think speaks back to our conversation about AI as well. And something that I think a lot of coaches don't do enough, which is bring themselves into the coaching conversation, mm-hmm. share the impact of being with that client. Yeah, of course, not in an unskillful way where you're telling them how they are, but, you know, it's always open to, you know, well, first of all, you're just sharing your experience of the impact, you know? And that I just find can be so transformational, and goes back to this thing we talked about of two humans being together and how you can't replace that in some way. So that's one thing, but just, I wanted to highlight that and then say everything you're saying now really speaks to me about something I've been thinking about, which is, what is coaching about? You know, like, what is it really about? And is it about success? You know, like, I think that, you know, we might say that's where a lot of coaching is about. It's about succeeding in life. I think that's fine. But when I hear you speak about your work, I wonder what you think about this. This notion of wisdom comes to mind for me, and how that is working on a different level than, you know, just orienting yourself to a future vision and trying to succeed. You know, you're going into some of these deep ontological beliefs, you know. And so what do you think about that? I'm, you know, other people I've been reading are thinking about this too, that maybe wisdom is a better kind of orienting principle.
Yeah, I think whatever somebody's bringing to coaching, I would be curious about what that means. If somebody brings success, I want to be more successful. I don't exclude that from being coachable through an existential lens. I'm just curious, okay, let's start with, what does it mean to you? I want to be a better leader. Career coaching. I hear so many coaches say, oh, I don't want to do career coaching. It's so boring. How could it possibly be boring? I mean, they're bringing their whole selves to their career very often. And if they don't bring their whole selves to their career, what's stopping them? And I mean, there's so much anxiety. There's so many assumptions. I mean, there's a complex human being in front of you, and they choose to bring into the coaching space a very narrow part of their life, perhaps. You know, so I naturally get curious. So I want to be happier. Well, what does that mean? You know, that means something else to all the people. So if someone brings something like success, well, what does that mean? How is that connected to what you believe in? Where have those beliefs come from? You know, and we don't need to spend, you know, 6 months exploring your meaning structures from a philosophical perspective. But I think it's important to acknowledge how something is connected to who you are as a person and your kind of wider framework of values and beliefs. And then all of a sudden, these seemingly narrow and limited concepts are all of a sudden opened up, and they're blossomed, and they already shift, and they become incredibly interesting, right? I want a promotion. That can lead to the most fascinating conversations. about who someone is, why they want that, where do they see themselves, what's the kind of legacy or impact they want to leave in the world, why do they think they exist, you know? And if you address that person's individual answers to those kind of questions, then things fall into place, and sometimes the goal shifts. You know, sometimes the initial desire that they came in with starts becoming different. That's a good result, you know. But like, I don't think there's any coaching goal ever that is not interesting. You know, I used to often put losing weight forward as a coaching goal that is just like not interesting, you know. And yes, it can be a pretty straightforward process. And I'm sure there is some research that AI weight loss coaches have performed better than human coaches, you know, which is interesting in itself.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think if we look at weight loss through an existential lens, it opens up a different kind of conversation, possibly a much more powerful conversation, possibly a less powerful conversation, you know, depending on who sits in front of us, depending on what they want and how quickly.
Sorry, I cut you off there. How would you do that? Like, say if someone was like, yeah, I want to explore weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
What question would you ask that would take it in that more existential?
Tell me about it. Yeah. That's always my go-to question. Tell me about it. You know, tell me some more. And then
what are you listening for? Yeah. When they answer.
Yeah.
That.
So one of the main tools, if you wanted to use that term, in existential coaching is phenomenological inquiry, right? Phenomenology is really the study of experience. So in that form of inquiry, you suspend everything that you think you know, and you really tune into that person's experience of whatever phenomenon they're talking about. And this could be walking into a place. It could be my experience of myself in my body. It could be the phenomenon of, you know, being within a group of friends and getting bullied. It could be reading a book and feeling something, or watching something on TV, seeing an advertising, or whatever it is, right? Looking into the mirror, that's a phenomenon. And so whatever phenomenon they pick up, you can tap into that experience and invite them to describe it more. Not to make sense of it, not to access pre-existing structures of interpretation, but really the experience of whatever that is. So if it's weight loss, there's something within the intellectual concept of weight loss that is an experience. And if you explore that experience, lots of meaning gets revealed. And often in the process of exploring that experience, new meanings emerge, because they're now somewhat free from we're circumventing the pre-existing meanings, and we're getting to the experiential ones. And so that process alone can already shift something. But what definitely happens is I hear people's values and beliefs and people's character strength and people's worldview in how they tell the story or how they describe their experience. So tell me more is a wonderful question. And then exploring within that more, and really staying with the phenomenon, it allows you an insight into who they are as people. And if you feed that back, make some observations, you know, that creates an awareness for that person from which they can move and shift into different ways of being, maybe challenge existing paradigms, recognize which of these values and beliefs were other people's values and beliefs. And that opens up that choice that we talked about, so that now they can choose who they want to be and how they want to be.
Do you think, so I love this. Do you think, it, you know, what's going on there basically? Like, is it that as they explore the phenomena, they're kind of inquiring into the subconscious or implicit beliefs and values that are withheld inside of that topic, you know, and so those are revealed, you know, and you as the coach can reflect those back, and you know, they might, whoa, okay, shit, I never realized that. But or is it that by going into the direct experience, there's something alive inside of that, you know, like you're actually moving into the living experience of the topic in a way that it reveals its depths and next, I don't know what to say, like manifestations or next phenomenological existence. And so you're actually moving the coaching conversation from being, on a, I don't want to say more superficial level, but you're on that, you're kind of going down into this something living, and then that's where the transformational currency is.
That lift experience. I love the language around that, right? Because that's where I'm careful with the word truth, right? Because it's often taken as this universal truth with a capital T. But I think it's more unfiltered. And what I'm trying to get to, or what I'm trying to open up, is something that is unfiltered by all these pre-existing systems of interpretation. And if you go to the lift experience, or if you tap into the unconscious, whether that's through dreams or through something that is directly felt, when somebody's under stress. I love snowboarding, and so when you see people on the mountain and they're in flow experiences, right? Anything that's a flow experience, anything that challenges us so much that we don't really have any time to think, so we don't. We're just in this state where we just are. We're just being, we're just living. And in that kind of state, you see people's truth, right? You see how they're really showing up because they're not stopping to think and consult all of these ideas of how I'm supposed to be. They're just being, right? And then, and so in those states, when you explore that, you see somebody's truth, and then you can offer it back to them, and hopefully they can see it too. And then also I recognize that if I see something, it's always my version of what I'm seeing. So I'm always influencing that. So really it's about what that person is seeing through that. So I can reflect something back, observe something, but always need to check in with that client. Sometimes we see different versions. We always see different versions, right? I see different versions of my client than the client sees themselves. But in that interaction with someone else, when we're being invited to go into a lift experience, it's amazing to me how many people just don't really do that. It's not really part of their life. It just, everything is so automated and there's so little time. And since I have kids, I get it a lot more. I used to judge it a lot more. It's easy to spend, not easy, wouldn't be easy for me, but I get why some people spend a decade and then realize, oh, what have I done the last decade? Where has time gone? What have we been doing? Like, who am I now? Still holding on to a version that you were 10 years ago when you figured out who you are, and now time's moved on. So I think when we get into those states, when we enter those states, it's a rich source of, truth, I guess, for lack of a better word right now.
Yeah, that resonates for me, and that's why I really love when you say, we just have a coaching conversation. I don't know where we're going to go. I think these aren't exactly your words, but it's not like there's a necessarily a goal or a vision. And I have that with my clients. Yeah, they come to coaching for a reason, but I don't know where the conversation's going to go. And but that sense of experience that you're describing is one that I'm kind of tracking as a coach, or that when that starts to open up, that's when you kind of, oh, this is we're in a really beautiful space here. And I'm just curious for you if you are tracking that as a coach, that kind of experience, and how do you keep, or how do you invite people into that phenomenological experience? Yeah. And keep them in there. Yeah.
So there's a lot around contracting, right? And I think that's a super interesting topic, because I used to say it's all about contract, 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 right? Have a conversation about the conversation, one of the most important things in coaching. I still do believe that, right? But as I've seen so many different coaches coach in the coaching lab, for example, or in demos, or as I've also just honestly reflected on my practice, there's been less contracting happening now than there used to be. And on the one hand, I really believe that the more you agree on the framework for this conversation, You know, there may be silences, or I might not give you advice, or, you know, I might invite you to enter a space that might be uncomfortable and that discomfort is valued, you know, and often helpful. Let's agree to not have a goal, right? It frees coaches up from, oh my God, am I doing it wrong? You know, all this second guessing for, am I doing it correctly? Having the ICF police somewhere in your mind thinking, I must create an action plan before we leave and ask about accountability. It needs to be a measurable progress in this session. I think that can be really important and it can really focus our clients, but also it can be in the way of the inquiry and the exploration that might be really needed here. So I love to have that conversation. If I get a sense in the beginning that this client just doesn't really know where this is going and it might not be helpful to force that, then we just agree that we're just going to go have a conversation. I trust that this is going somewhere because I know it's always going somewhere, right? So if we can both agree that we both trust that or choose to trust that, then that's a really good agreement. And that's a solid contract that you have in place because it doesn't have to be a smart goal. You know, it can also be really vague as long as you have a sense of direction. And if you don't have a sense of direction, you agree that in the absence of a sense of direction, you're still going to have a conversation because maybe a sense of direction is what they're looking for. And yes, of course, you could make that a smart goal. You could smarten that goal up. You know, there's Simon Weston, for example. I talked to him a couple of times on the podcast. He has got a psychoanalytic approach. He always asks his clients, well, what's your desire? You know, and if you start a conversation like that, that it already kind of circumvents some of the pre-existing frameworks for clients and for coaching, and it kind of disrupts the conversation from the get-go and opens up another conversation and it makes people think. So how do I invite people in? Well, when it comes to phenomenological inquiry, it's just, I don't think you need to necessarily invite people into a phenomenological space. You can just get curious about the experience. I think a lot of coaching is following your curiosity because your curiosity is one of the aspects and qualities that really serves a person in front of you. So if you have an agreement in place that you're going to follow your curiosity, then you don't need to have a whole conversation about, oh, now we're going to do this process, which is called this, and this is how it works. Maybe that could be helpful for a client, but I find in my conversation, a lot of that flows a lot more. And while you do create a framework in the beginning about what coaching is, what it entails, what it might be like, what are you expecting from me? What do I expect from you? You know, I think that's important. But then a lot of it is happening in the moment. And if you were to address it too much, then, you know, now we said we're going to do a phenomenological inquiry. So now we're going to have to stick with it. And very often that sort of inquiry, it might be a few moments, might be a few minutes. It might be a prolonged period of time. But I think in coaching, we're always weaving in and out of different states. We always, there's this tuning in and tuning out process. When I'm tuning in, I'm inquiring phenomenologically, or I'm just super present. I suspend everything that I think I know. But then I might be tuning out and often like physically just lean back and consider, what do I have in my bag? What is my experience of this? What do I think about that? What is my opinion? Might I have a piece of advice even that might be really helpful here? You know, might I have a story to tell that really resonates? Is there something that pops up in my mind that I just want to put on the table and see whether my client's vibing with it? You know, so at that tuning out, this is where all the theory, all the philosophy, all the different approaches really let their value flourish. And this is where coaching gets different. In the tuning in process, I think it's often very similar what different coaches do.
Mm, yeah, nice. I like that distinction between tuning out and tuning in. I want to make sure we talk about the coaching lab. But just before we do that, could you just tell me, if coaches wanted to become more existential in their coaching, they would need to train on this. But what would you what advice would you give people, or what ways could people start to bring some of that lens into their coaching right now?
So it's interesting. One of the feedbacks I hear most often from running existential coach trainings is that there's always at least a couple of people in the room that said, oh, this resonates so much. I've already been thinking this. I've already been feeling this is what I believe. This is my home. I just didn't really have the language for it. So it felt like a homecoming because now somebody, you know, that experience when you read something or you hear somebody speak and you're like, yeah, exactly, that's exactly it. But I was never able to formulate it like that. And oh my God, now I have a model and a graphic or, you know, a body of work, more literature to dive into and a community, a sense of professional belonging, if you will, or philosophical belonging that before it was there, but you didn't have the frame and the community for it. So that's often what happens. And those people, they've already trained their whole life in a way because they've been reflecting on the big questions. They've been reading philosophy, even if it wasn't existential philosophy. They've been asking themselves questions. They've been inquiring phenomenologically. They just didn't know that that's what they were doing. I think most coaches, and this is a colleague from mine in Mexico, Yaki Martinez, he said most coaches use some form of phenomenology in their practice quite naturally, even if they've never studied phenomenology. You know, and studying phenomenology or existentialism will let you go even deeper, will kind of ground it more and give you more confidence because, you know, it's not just something that you do, but there's people who studied this at depth. And you know why it works now, and you can do more of it. You can use it in a more pointed way, for example. So a training is good, right? But a lot of people already practice existentially, and there's a lot of elements in people's coaching that are clearly existential to me because I have that kind of language. There's so many meeting points to other ways of coaching as well. Study it, practice it, but people will find that they've already practiced quite a lot of that.
Yeah. And I hear, you know, a lot of existential themes here in what you've already named, you know, like endings, beginnings, transitions, you know, meaning and meaninglessness, finding choice, you know. So there's these themes, it seems like, inside of existentialism that seem to be commonly popping up. Maybe I'm reducing it too simplistically there. Maybe, yeah. Yeah.
No, especially in this day and age, the speed of development, of human development, societal, political development, it's nauseating. You know, we can't possibly keep up. We have access to all of these people's experience of living. We have an awareness of all these different possibilities of what living could be like. You know, imagine you're in a leadership position. And I think anybody who recognizes responsibility in their actions is in a leadership position, whether that's being the head of your own body, the head of a company, a group, a friend, a book club, or, you know, a world leader. There's a lot of responsibility and people seek freedom. It's often, usually when you hear freedom, there's very positive associations with it. But if you look at it through an existential lens, we need to recognize that, you know, freedom is also nauseating. You know, the dizziness of freedom, as Kierkegaard describes it. Having too many choices is anxiety provoking. So given that we have so much choice now, that so many people have so much more choice than they used to, is anxiety provoking, right? Every choice excludes all the other possibilities that you could have chosen in that moment, and you can never go back into that moment of time and choose differently. So of course there's people who are dreading making any choices, who are sitting there and, you know, having to choose which pick to take from the lunch menu, you know, and they're tormenting themselves. I get it, right? So imagine now your decisions and your choices influence the lives of hundreds, thousands, or the lives of one significant other that you care about. Of course, it's difficult to make choices. And pretty much all of coaching is about making choices in some way or another. So in that sense, it's really helpful to explore deeply our relationship with freedom as one of the conditions of the human condition that we can't get away from. That's the thing about existential givens. Like, the only way to not have existential anxiety is by not existing, or by continuously distracting yourself from that awareness. And then you have people living in autopilot and wondering where the hell the last 10 years have gone.
Do you think, this is a bit off topic and we will talk about the coaching lab, but do you think people who are engaged in spiritual practice and awaken and open, that's resolving on some level that existential anxiety? I mean, maybe an unfair question to ask you. Is getting more into my own passions here.
Yeah. Yes and no. I don't think that, I mean, there's a lot of anxiety that we can transcend, right? I don't think the existential anxiety we can, because we're still going to be human in the world with other people. And we can learn to embrace the tension between, you know, not wanting to ever think about our death and knowing that we will definitely die sooner or later. You know, there's tension there, but tension also breeds energy, right? The lightning strike is between two tensions of positive and negative energy, physically, right? Physics. A battery has a positive and a negative pole. There's tension, it creates energy, it creates electricity, right? So Freud talks about tension between the ego and the superego and the id. So there's energy from that. So I think we can embrace and have a more positive relationship with that tension and that anxiety. Existential anxiety doesn't mean it's something bad that we need to avoid. It's uncomfortable, but discomfort is just part of human existence. That doesn't mean that it's something to be avoided or something bad. That's why I don't like negative emotions. Often positive psychology, we talk about positive emotions. Negative, there's no positive and negative emotions. There's maybe more and less pleasant emotions. There's very difficult emotions. Doesn't mean that they're to be avoided. They're just part of our life. So I think when you talk about that, the way that I believe, from what I know about you around spiritual awakening, I think there's an awakening to the spectrum of life, and that suffering doesn't necessarily mean we're suffering in the more traditional sense of what that means to a lot of people, but it just means that there's a difficult experience that we can then choose meaning into. Viktor Frankl said that meaning is always possible. Right? We can always choose meaning. We can find meaning in suffering. And then suffering is not necessarily less painful, but it doesn't become something to be avoided at all cost. It becomes part of our story. And I think if we learn to tell ourselves a story, if we choose to tell ourselves a different story about our suffering, then the experience of suffering changes phenomenologically.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think, and as well, beautifully spoken, and that you're describing a practice that's a practice I found in many traditions, you know, embracing that tension instead of trying to transcend it or, you know, deny it or numb yourself out from it. But there's actually an incredible potential or excitement or, you know, possibility by embracing that tension, not by trying to solve it, you know, then it goes away. That's the trick there, isn't it? You know, but
yeah. And the coaching lab is actually very much alive in almost everything that we've talked about, right? At any point in turning point, I could have made a reference to it, because I've seen all of these different coaches, many of whom I know, others I've never met, but I got curious about their approach. And I see the range of what coaching can be, life in the room as it's unfolding. And I know we talked about this before. It's such a privilege to be a fly on the wall when somebody who's experienced does a thing, right? Something happens. And I hear people talk about the magic of coaching. Some seems magical, but actually when you start looking into it and dissecting it a bit and getting curious and being critical, right? Critical is quite a positive thing. You know, it's like, where the hell did that question come from? How did you experience that silence? Like, oh my God, this was just like a guided meditation for 45 minutes. Like, was that useful? Well, let's ask the client, huh? You know, was it useful? somebody just blatantly giving advice and guidance, or just teaching or mentoring. Or sometimes just like, hey, that was a therapy session. I mean, wasn't it? Was it for you? Do you even care? Like, what are the ethics around it? What's your ethical framework for making those decisions? You know, so it's great to see so many different coaches with so many different lenses work with people in so many different ways, and then kind of taking a look under the hood of what they're doing there and how they made certain decisions, what theoretical frameworks were operating in the background. And for some, there's none there. It's just all intuitive. And others are like so informed by theory, and at every point in time, the back of their mind is working beautifully at, you know, crafting ways through a conversation. And whatever I ask them, they tell me exactly why they made certain decisions inside the coaching space. So, you know, some is just spiritual emergence happening in front of you. And for others, it's just like cognitive problem solving. So it's been just amazing to see the range. And I think coaches get a lot from that, because when we are in coach training, very often most coach trainings tell us, this is how you need to do it, you know, because it's difficult to teach coaching at a high maturity level to people who just find themselves in it. I think it's helpful to have some more simple answers in the beginning and then opening them up as we mature and develop. But I see a lot of coaches in supervision really being weighed heavy on by this responsibility and this expectation that coaching needs to be a certain way. And you're being given a set of rules, and then you feel like you're breaking them because intuitively it seems to be the right choice. But you're like, but I'm not supposed to do that. That's not supposed to be coaching. And if you then see someone who's been coaching for 20 years doing exactly the thing that you thought you should not do, and it works beautifully, and it really opens something up, I feel coaches then meet their own clients with a different perspective and a different feeling. And I think if coaches find that kind of center and that kind of confidence in, if I hold space for someone and I'm being present, and yes, theoretical frameworks and processes are important, methodologies are important, but maybe I don't need to hold on to them so tightly and really allow myself to be present with someone, I think it benefits so many clients of coaches who maybe are less experienced. And I think if we're really experienced, it's really rare that we see other coaches coach. You know, once we're outside of our training rooms, it can be really lonely, right? I'm always connected to other coaches. I love hanging out with other coaches, but there's a lot of coaches, once they start coaching and have a successful business, they have these deep conversations, but they rarely get to kind of connect with other practitioners because they're just so busy doing their work. So it's just been a wonderful community and expansion of what even I believe possible with coaching.
Mm. Yeah.
We have a chatbot in the lab, maybe not in time for this to be released, but I'm so excited to see Alpina, who was developed by Rebecca Rutschmann, here, a German colleague here in Karlsruhe. ChatGPT-based chatbot. I mean, when do you get to sit in on a coaching session between a chatbot and a real client, you know, and then ask the creator, why the hell did it do that? And where did that come from? And, you know, I'm probably half the time more excited than anybody who comes to the lab about seeing that person coach. Because you talk about coaching with so many people, right? And I talk to so many coaches about coaching, and I rarely get to see them in the room actually doing the thing that they've been talking about. And sometimes I'm quite surprised at how different it looks to how I had imagined it.
Yeah. I love, that's why I love you've created this. We did our own version, like a recording coaches.
Yeah. I know.
Coaching and then debriefing. And I share that because it was also surprising sometimes, you know, uh-huh. And in positive and ways where you're like, oh, okay, interesting. So I think it's an incredibly rich way for people to learn. I want to encourage people listening to check out your coaching lab, because I just really feel your love of this profession and your joy of learning around it. And it's such a powerful way to learn, such a powerful way, because you're going to see people do things in all the ways you just described, that that challenge you, confuse you, amaze you, and then you can break it down as to why they, what they were thinking in that moment. So there was a thing you said, and I just wanted to like double click on it, which was, and I can't, you said like it's like amazing me with what's possible with coaching or something. You said it just a moment, and I don't know if you can remember saying that. It was just like a minute ago.
Yeah,
I
remember.
Was just curious what you meant by that.
Yeah. Well, the depth and the breadth that some coaches take coaching, right? Even just integration of different ways of being with people. So, you know, just leaning into your mentoring hat or your teaching hat, you know, just fully confidently bringing in a large amount of psychoeducation, you know, just because that seems to be the thing that's going to be most helpful right now. And I happen to just have knowledge and information, and, you know, not having to have your puristic facilitative coaching hat on. I often think about Heron's intervention styles, which have been around since the 70s, right? That there's an authoritative side and there's a facilitative side, right? There's a way of working with people where you give advice or you prescribe, you know, a little bit less so, but still authoritative, is you put some information on the table and you let them do with it what they want. You know, all the way to being cathartic or catalytic, you know, where you hold space where someone can really work through and process something and you're not guiding or pointing anyone in anywhere. You know, so I think whenever anybody says anything or does anything or is just there, you can decide where on that kind of playing field, what are you going to utilize? And I think most coaches, most practitioners have their, like their modus operandi, their style, minus usually challenging and exploring. But, you know, especially when I work with coaches, I do have a lot of experience to draw on. You know, I do have a lot of information I could put on the table. I do have some advice that would probably be helpful in certain occasions. You know, my modus operandi is helping somebody to form their own advice and go their own path. But, you know, over the years, just this integrative approach came out. And in the, what I see in the coaching lab, or when I hear people's different perspectives on the podcast, it shifts, it pushes onto your own boundaries. It kind of, it, you know, it moves certain things, and some boundaries they don't move and you rebel against it. And sometimes there's a bit of a hole there. And then all of a sudden there's all of this space and you realize, oh, I had never thought to push there. You know, yeah. I thought that was just a given, and all of a sudden you push that and it all falls apart and you're like, I didn't know you could do that. Huh. And then to just kind of try it out in a safe environment where you don't have a paying client, you don't have that kind of responsibility, and the agreement is we're just going to play with things, right? Hence coaching lab. You know, sometimes we learn the most when the whole thing explodes into our face, or it falls over, or nothing happens, right? Making sense of why nothing happened is sometimes the best learning experience. And we had a few sessions in the lab where just it wasn't a good match, right? The approach of the coach wasn't a match. Or we had a somatic session where the client wanted to go into the body and they said they would, but they just weren't. And the coach didn't push them to do it, because I think, and they agreed, that would have, you know, that would have not been right.
Yeah.
So nothing happened for 45 minutes, really. But then making sense of what was going on for the coach in his mind and why he did or didn't push and where and how. Oh, wow. That really opened up a lot. So that's why, I mean, you know, what coaching can be, because there isn't one thing that is coaching. It's everybody has to figure out their own framework of what coaching is and isn't, and learn to communicate that with a client so that they can give you an informed consent to work with you or not.
Yeah, and I think that's where you become a mature coach, when you're able to formulate in that way. And so, hey, Yannick, this has been a really enjoyable conversation for me. And I just want to give people, well, you the opportunity to let people know where they can find out more about the coaching lab and the other things you do. So, yeah, could you tell us?
Yeah, thank you. GoCoachingLab.com. Or if you go just Google Yannick's Coaching Lab, you'll find stuff. I have a website called rocketsupervision.com, where it's kind of the hub for everything I do for and with coaches. So that'll be a good address here. And existential.coach is my coaching website for the existential work, but it also includes a couple of other things. I have a YouTube channel. Just Google me. I'll pop up. So always happy to hear from people and what they take from this, right? These conversations. I hope that we've had a conversation just now with a lot of people, and that those people, you listening, watching this, have a conversation with other people based on what we've kind of sparked. And if that goes somewhere, if any of that resonates and it creates something, I'd love to hear about it. So always happy to have people reach out to me.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you, Yannick. And we'll link to some of those websites, or the websites you named, in our show notes as well. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.